You are listening to an episode of Backrow Movie News. The podcast name and scope has changed. It is now the Broken Record Podcast, but you can still enjoy the past episodes of Backrow Movie News on this feed. Make sure you follow the Broken Record Podcast or Podcast Broken Record, depends on what social media site, on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for updates on future episodes. What's going on, you guys? Welcome and thank you for tuning in to Backrow Movie News and The Alien Legacy. Today, I'm going to be reviewing and recapping Alien Prototype, a 2019 novel by Tim Wagner. That's right here on Backrow Movie News. Welcome to the Best Seat in the House, everybody. I'm Chase Kupo. All right, so Alien Prototype. As I said under a minute ago, it's a 2019 novel written by Tim Wagner. He's worked on a lot of series dealing with science fiction or supernatural elements. Star Trek and Supernatural are two obvious good examples. He specializes in horror and thriller stories within the fantasy and the sci-fi settings. The basic synopsis of this novel is: when an industrial spy steals a xenomorph egg, former Colonial Marine Zula Hendrix must prevent an alien from killing everyone on an isolated colony planet. To say it simply, I really like this story. All right, thank you guys for listening. Now, okay, so it has a nice balance that I think... Kaysen liked that one. It has a nice balance that I think a lot of expanded universe novels in any franchise, but especially this one, don't normally have. It does a nice job of being an alien story that functions similar to really any one that we've experienced before, but it also adds in new ideas and experiences. It does this while not going too far. It's a good balance, as I like to say. I find that a lot of novels try to do new things, but they're also wacky and ridiculous that it doesn't work in the end. There's always clones or weird hybrid animals, new planets. Books and comics get so weird and so far from the works in a franchise after a while, and it's why I don't usually bother with it. The best example, yeah, it's all too much. Too much. No, the best example for me is the former Star Wars canon. Alien isn't quite that deep yet, but Alien isn't quite that deep yet, but there have been a few horrible misses in recent memory. I'm looking at you, Alien Covenant Origins, and Aliens Sea of Sorrows. Those two titles had me weary leading into Prototype. Prototype isn't one of these cases. As I said, I think it shines in almost every way. The basic story and its structure are, while maybe not crazy and new, they're very solid. The main characters are really well done. It is unfortunate that in a series, the first movie and its characters are always going to be the inspiration for the archetypes that appear in every single other iteration from then on. Zula Hendrix is a character that did originate in the comics. This was her first time in any other medium, actually. She's an amalgamation of Hicks and Ripley. You know, Hicks from Aliens, Ripley from all of them. Now, I do say that lightly, because she's a strong leading woman that recalls Ripley, just she recalls Ripley, and since she's a Colonial Marine, she kind of gives off the sort of Hicks vibe, you know? So she's actually pretty fresh in my mind. It's because her story is a little different than what we've seen before. Her story is one of strife. It's a constant comeback story. Someone or something is always standing on her wrists, holding her back. Sometimes it's even herself. She has to always fight for who she is, what she represents, and to survive. It sounds pretty heavy, right? Surprisingly, isn't that heavy in execution. Wagner and the comic writers before him, actually, I'll give them some credit, even though I didn't like the comic she's part of, choose not to ham it up. Sure, those are some serious issues, and she doesn't have it easy at all, but she's really down to earth and practical. She's a real person. That's what she feels like, at least. Sure, she has problems, but they and she don't wax poetical or make every scene and moment some life or death big event, you know? They don't get too dramatic. Tamar Prather is the corporate spy that kicks off the downfall of the Carnage by locating and stealing an Overmorph, a Xenomorph egg. The egg that holds one of my favorite nightmares, the Facehugger. She's another really interesting character, actually. She more closely matches Ellen Ripley, mainly in her physical demeanor, I guess. Tall, lanky, rough edges when needed, but still rounded out as someone with some depth. And that's as close as they get to each other in terms of comparisons. Prather is a spy and a damn good one. She can beat most people or things in a fight. She does it with brawn and brains, and, you know, depending on the enemy, she'll switch to whatever she needs more. She did it several times in the book. I don't want to downplay the character too much, but it does feel pretty standard when I kind of write and talk about it here. She's a spy, so she cuts herself off from all close relationships. She struggles sometimes with that loneliness, but she's always willing to do what she needs to get that payday. And of course, in the end, she proves herself as a valiant person when she dies in battle and to save other people. The character has enough life in her that she really is pretty compelling, and it's kind of nice to see her change from that heartless spy to a half-heartless spy. But once again, it just feels a tiny bit cliche. It's just well executed. Her and Zula actually don't cross paths too often in the first half or so of the novel, but when they do, there are some good moments. The two really bring two separate and valid energies to the fold, and they clash, but both slowly get to understand the other a little bit as the story progresses. It feels mostly natural to me. I thought it was well done. I would call them really the two main characters. It's kind of an ensemble, but no one else quite sticks out as much. Azula is on the colony at this point because she has been hired to train their security forces since she's an ex-Marine with combat experience. Minimal combat experience, but combat experience nonetheless. Her and the trainees have this thing, a power struggle. She's new, and the trainees were together before she came along. That, plus her young age and mysterious past, lead to tension, and it's really a key point in the novel. Once again, this is a group dynamic that I think is seen a lot in stories, but once again, it's well done. The trainees don't really get a chance to shine, per se. They get a few scenes of development, and Wagner makes sure to have a few interactions with Zula and a few specific trainees to build the rapport, so that in the end of the story, we can't help but care a little bit when people start getting ripped apart and coughed on. More on that in a bit. Dr. Gagnon, I do not know how to pronounce. I feel like that's how I pronounce this guy's name. It's spelled G-A-G-N-O-N. Is it Gannon with the silent G? I don't know, whatever. Dr. G is okay. Definitely a little cheesy. And the same goes for the woman who is the head of the facility. They feel as if they kind of slipped through the cracks a little bit during the process. They have purpose, and they work, but they aren't really too interesting. Dr. G has a lot more potential, though. Well, he had. He doesn't make it through this ordeal, unfortunately. To finish up on the characters, the androids really do shine in this novel, and in a different way than we've seen before, which is kind of becoming, it basically always has been since the second movie really cemented the focus on them, but an important part of the Alien franchise is how the synthetics in each story, how they are. Bridget, Dr. G's assistant, and Davis, Zula's friend. Bridget is interesting as she's used to show that androids in this universe, well, both are, but hers feels more, there's no past history with her like Davis, so we already kind of know, if you've read the comics, you know Davis is Davis. But we explore the fact that androids do have feelings and morality with Bridget. Bridget is she's a former sex model that was reassigned because she lashed out against a man trying to force himself on her. Dr. G had his doubts. He doesn't like androids. They creep him out, he says. And definitely gets weird vibes because Bridget is attractive, but still an android. And she shows signs of humanity. She hesitates when assisting with the Overmorph experiment. in that experiment, they use a volunteer from the colony that thinks he's going to be testing a drug or something, but he gets fucked in the face with an alien, and then he gives birth to one later. Bridget is very sweet and good-hearted overall. She's pretty easy to understand, and she comes across as what I think she is. Davis does the same thing, basically. Not the fucking thing. But both he and Bridget are examples of how human and androids in this franchise are or can be. It feels like a statement to me. And looks like I didn't write this down, but it's important to mention the fact that Bridget was a former sex model that was reassigned. This came out after, so there's... If you watch this, you've probably heard me mention the Charon, that alien fan audio drama series on YouTube. Literally, the guy that the creator of it, he literally has a character. He created a character like that before this came out. So guess who did it first? That guy. Davis, he's been with Zula since her first appearance in the comics. He is an android, one with a really blank design. It's similar to the working Joes in Alien Isolation. He was a combat android, and he revolted against his mission and his squad to live his own life and save Zula. The two, who ran into xenomorphs on their adventures, obviously, set off together traveling through space, determined to try and find and wipe out all the xenomorphs and facilities meant to study or utilize them. Davis is actually very human. He even reprogrammed himself to actually feel emotions and pain, and he's learning to be human. His body is damaged too far beyond repair at the end of their most recent comic book adventure, but Zula has his consciousness saved and she keeps him with her. He's like her Google assistant, or, you know, her Echo Dot. Although he can hack into systems and he knows stuff and he talks to her through an earpiece. That's probably going to happen one day. Look out. Judgment Day is upon us. Now, they've become really close friends, and really, honestly, they've flirted on the line with, like, romantic relationship. It hasn't come up, but both are sort of feeling it. And if I can catch the vibes, then they are some strong vibes. But, you know, so they've sort of been feeling it, but I don't think either of them are saying it, you know? Davis was actually well done here. In the comics, he was cool enough, but since I don't like the comics, I don't really give a fuck. But now he's a good reaffirming presence for our struggling hero, and he kind of proves his existence. He at one point he has to infiltrate the colony system to prevent disease from spreading. More on that in a bit. And he has to fight the colony's AI. It responds to the foreign body in it, and it seeks to purge the intruder for safety. It only follows protocol. There's an example of AI that's nowhere near the humanity that we see in Bridget or Davis. The parallels. It's good writing. The scene is really cool, actually, to read. They take human form or shape in, like, this digital space, and they actually fight. Or, you know, they shift into, like, other shapes and stuff, and they attack each other. Bridget has to join in at one point, and she sacrifices herself to give Davis an upper hand. It'd probably be really cheesy, and it feels like some bad riff on, like, the visuals of Tron or The Matrix if this was, like, in a movie or realized on the screen somehow. But I did like the emotion in the book. So the characters and their dynamics were really pretty outstanding. The setting of the story and the corporate conflict were not the most interesting, but they were interesting. Maybe the most interesting, I don't know. Venture Corporation is the company this time around. They're actively pursuing the interests of Weyland-Yutani. It's a tale of corporate espionage, which it kind of follows in what they've been doing in the most recent novels anyway. It's all kind of got similar themes. In this case, gone wrong. The espionage has gone wrong, I should say. Tamar Prather is undercover within a group of pirates in the opening of the book. The crew is, well, pirating a vessel, and Prather finds a hidden overmorph in the captain's quarters and recognizes it as possibly being the rumored egg of the beast that Weyland-Yutani is rumored to always be after. It's interesting that the xenomorph is sort of like a rumored or a mythical being, at least in this novel or at this point in the time. Some have heard of it, or like a slight description of it, or even the carnage that it caused, and that the company's looking for it, but that's it. It's just sometimes, since like we live in a world where like this is like all the movies and books and games, it just feels like sometimes it feels like there's xenomorphs all over this goddamn universe and everyone should know about it. But in a novel like this, I think Wagner used that language to kind of shift it back to being something mysterious that not too many people know about. I liked it. Prather, she takes her bounty to her boss on the planet Jericho 3. On it is a venture facility called The Lodge. Definitely sounds sexy, but it's not, trust me. There's also a proto-colony as the company attempts to set up shop on Jericho 3. Venture is... it is what it is. I mean, there's some setup, but right now it's just another company that's trying to get the Xenomorph, and they're just trying to catch up and surpass Weyland-Yutani. Dr. G is a less than ethical scientist that the head of facilities employs, and they literally have him there just so he can do something, like anything, cure a disease, discover a new species, something groundbreaking, something to get ahead of the curve. He does plenty of experiments, but it has not totally paid off. An example of what Venture will do to try and make their path forward... oh, that is an example of what they'll do. They'll do pretty much anything, whether it's ethical, unethical. They'll hire this person, that person, anything they can do to get, you know, a chance, just a crumb of a chance to be as good as Weyland-Yutani. It's an interesting angle. I think... it's one we've seen before. Alien Isolation introduced Seegson, and Cold Forge, the novel, brought them back and way further down the timeline from Isolation, but even past this book in terms of timeline. But they're still hanging around trying to get hold of Weyland-Yutani's prize, the Xenomorph. I was intrigued at the proto-colony and seeing this stage of colonization. But once again, that is what it is. There wasn't too much time to get into that in this novel. There was actually a couple living in the colony that was the focus of a teeny tiny little subplot, and it kind of detailed how they had drifted and come to, like, literally hate each other, living in such close quarters and such harsh conditions. They basically exist to be a payoff. They get a sort of detailed setup. They get you into the emotion that this couple is just totally deteriorated to a point where they're two people they don't know and they hate each other, only later to fall victim to the Xenomorph that's running loose. They gotta make us care for these random citizens before they die, I suppose. They did have a sad death scene, I'll say that. But now we're talking about the main attraction, the creatures. I liked it. All right, thank you. No, okay. Now, I had a bad taste in my mouth after the horrible writing of the Xenomorph in the novelization of Alien Isolation. So this was a welcome return to form. The first stage we spend time with is the egg, the Ovomorph. I feel like it's easy for me or anyone to just see the Ovomorph and be like, there it is, when's the facehugger going to pop out, you know? I'm ready for the facehugger, get it over with. We're done here. But Wagner didn't do that this time. There was a good section early on in the book in which Dr. G had the egg and he was able to test it. He sent Bridget in and it didn't react to her because she's non-organic. That's something that we've always kind of known about androids there. Do you have to chew so loudly? No, here. That's something we've always kind of known about androids in the Alien franchise, and it was something that was in like a deleted concept for Aliens, but it's nice to see it once again officially here. In a very visceral way, Wagner really, really milked the tension with the egg, and this was the first time that I remember it being focused on in such a way. He went on about the smell, the putrid, intoxicating smell, and he even added something to canon. When the test subject, Hassan, is trapped in the chamber with it, he's, of course, initially frightened and he's weary of what's going to go down. But, so he initially displays some semblance of a brain by avoiding it. But as soon as he lets his guard down, when he does, he moves a little closer. And when he touches the egg, not only does it react, but it reacts. But so does he. Wagner, the writer, he basically says that the egg releases a sort of pheromone, and it sort of seduces the victim or puts him in a trance, draws him closer and closer, and it's not really broken until the facehugger emerges, and it totally fucks him in the face. So I thought it was really cool in the addition to the Xenomorph attributes. It explains why so many big dumb idiots have stuck their face in that area. I mean, there are other reasons that we can extrapolate or make from the subtext to please ourselves, but you know. I'm sorry, there's somebody in this room who cannot keep their composure. This is a nice addition to those layers. It also isn't the most significant or canon-altering thing ever, so it doesn't have to come up in every Alien story from here on out. We don't have to see this done to death. Wagner really focused a lot on how the xenomorph and its senses work and how they're utilized. And he does the same for the humans, actually, as evidenced most obviously by the training exercises and then the interactions with the xenomorph, the training exercises with Zula and her trainees. The facehugger, it's not really stressed as much in this novel. And also, Dr. G's samples of the overmorph seem to point to the egg itself being like a living being as well. It isn't an autonomous being, but it lives like a tree, I guess. Just a really violent tree. And that's part of the pheromones and whatnot. The sort of beings, that sort of brings a whole new creepy vibe to the game. It's a whole new goddamn ballgame. As for the big bad xenomorph itself, I liked it, but I'm a little conflicted. The big twist or the remix of the beloved and feared creature is that it has cellular necrosis. Cellular necrosis is a deadly disease that the test subject, Hassan, was previously infected with in medical trials by Dr. G. Dr. G had developed a cure for the disease. Well, at least he did one thing right. But in theory, the disease cells remained dormant, or some such scientific and medical thing, in the patient. That led to the xenomorph having the disease when it was birthed. It's a tough little son of a bitch, though. Instead of succumbing to the disease, as it nearly does upon birth, it comes out, it bursts out of him, and they think, like, they're all, him and Bridget, Dr. G and Bridget are shocked. They're like, you know, what is this? Blah, blah, blah. And then it starts getting these, like, boils on its skin, and it's screaming, and I literally thought, wow, is it gonna die? It doesn't succumb to the disease. It actually works the disease into its physiology. This is a twist on the usual formula of a xenomorph taking on traits of its hosts. Usually it's because it's born like from a different animal, a monkey or an ox, as we've seen in Alien 3 and we've seen in The Cold Forge. But this time, well, read about in The Cold Forge, but this time it's due to a different kind of organism, a virus. It's a really good call to introduce the scenario, actually. I don't recall seeing someone theorize on that in any forum or post or fan fiction that I've seen or heard of. Now, the virus is potent in this form, and it forms these boils, as I said, all over the chestburster's body, causing it searing pain like literally every moment it exists. Wagner stresses that throughout the novel, that it's always in pain, and this virus is telling it to do one thing, and it's normal, like psychology is telling it to do another thing. And this searing pain stresses the xenomorph, and it drives it as well. The facehugger actually takes on and kills at least one person, and this novel goes into how it does require sustenance to grow quickly, something that I think is not new to the canon, but there's never been time to show it in a movie. For example, I mean, you can infer it like in Alien when the chestburster and the smaller xenomorph killed what? I think it got two crew members. I think it only ate Parker. But still, it's just this novel kind of points out for it to grow as quickly as they do and have the life cycle that they do, it's got to eat when it's young. Dr. G dubs it as the necromorph, which I actually really like. It's commonly referred to as death or worse than that, as they love to say in novels. They'll say it looks like death itself or worse. But, you know, so this whole cycle kind of... flirting with death and coming back. I don't know. It's not quite like that, but the life cycle sort of calls that to mind for me. It's a cool name for this iteration of the xenomorph, is what I'll say. So the necromorph grows rapidly, and it is still in pain constantly. It's conflicted as it sets out to live. Its usual drive is only to kill and propagate its species. That's it. That's all it's like thinking about. Kill and reproduce. Now, though, the cellular necrosis is like a second conscience, a split personality. It constantly drives a necromorph to spread the disease. That's what disease wants to do. It wants to spread. A disease only exists to spread and move to new cells and hosts. So the necromorph is always in a mad scramble to kill as many people as possible in its normal, violent, and physical ways, find the right area to begin morphing an egg, and then spread the cellular necrosis. It does this in two ways. The disgusting way is the boils on its skin. The outer carapace, wow, I don't know how to pronounce that. Whatever, I'll spell it on the screen. No, I'll forget that. Anyways, the outer carapace? The outer carapace of the necromorph is as tough to penetrate as usual, but now it has boils all over for added protection. Literally, when they burst, they spew liquid doses of cellular necrosis. And then they regenerate, so it's even harder to kill this thing than before. You wouldn't dare kill it. The stupid and dumb way, it's sort of stupid, sort of dumb, I don't know. It's just, is that the inner mouth of the creature, you know, the classic inner mouth of the alien, it literally, like, sticks out, and then it, like, coughs. It's like, right on people, just straight up, just coughs right into their face, and that's how the disease is spread. I mean, it's kind of realistic. That can happen. Well, we're going through a pandemic right now where it can spread through the air. Yeah, I think it can. No, maybe it's only surfaces. Whatever. The alien can cough on people and it gets them fucking sick. So this disease is super potent. And in this case, it spreads through immediately through contact. So that cough into your face or any orifice on your body is a sure way to transmit it. And still, it just seems too stupid. It seems so stupid that this frightening, athletic hunter of a creature just runs up, grabs people, and coughs on them. It's a little weird. But sometimes, although I would be scared, I'd be scared out of my damn mind if that happened, but sometimes people go a little too far with things. Christ. They're going a little too far with it. We all do that every day. We all go a little bit too far. So, I think that the beast is very intimidating and cool this time around. It felt scary and inevitable, which is something the alien doesn't always feel, especially in recent movies. It had a high kill count, and it showed its cunning, power, and resilience through tough situations. It was one of the strongest characters in the book. It's really the xenomorph, honestly, at the height of its power. I think this is one of the best examples of a xenomorph succeeding that we've seen until it died. But that does wrap it up. Thank you for listening. If you like alien or science fiction and horror in general, I suggest reading a copy of this one or listening to the audiobook. You can always check out the previous episode of the Alien Legacy. It's all on YouTube. We're on the channel right there. You can't miss it, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Also be on the lookout for my What's the Deal episode about Wallace from Blade Runner 2049. I don't know what's going to be up first. I don't know if this is going to make sense or not. Bye. Well, that about wraps it up for today, you guys. Thank you so much for checking out this episode. In the meantime, you can go subscribe to our YouTube channel, drop a comment down below. Let us know how you feel about today's content or anything you want to bring to the discussion. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Backroom Movie News for updates on upcoming videos coming to you guys. And also, you can visit BackroomMovieNews.com for news updates from this guy, Two Thumbs.